You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show. It's a Monday, which means it's our opportunity to start the week off right. So I hope that we're going to be able to do that together over the next couple of hours. Settle in for the ride, and we got a great show should be ahead. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to be talking with Diego Cupolo. He's a photojournalist who lives in Turkey right now, actually. Very well traveled, Mr. Cupolo. I had him on a few weeks ago to talk about his sort of firsthand account of the attempted coup there in Turkey and the aftermath, the so-called purge going on there by the Turkish President Erdogan. Well, the things continue. The purge continues, so we're going to get an update from Diego at the bottom of the hour. Things seems like the implications of the purge of any sort of political resistance, and many ways it seems like perhaps being used as an excuse to tighten Erdogan's grip on power. So we'll talk to Diego Cupolo from Ankara at the bottom of the hour. And then the second hour, special guest today, this actually emerged last night through a Facebook conversation, a friend of mine, Andy Cunningham. Andy, who is a pastor on staff at Chapelwood United Methodist Church in Houston, Texas. Massive church. Everything they say is bigger in Texas, and that's oftentimes true of churches. But my friend Andy Cunningham went to the same seminary I went back in my days as a Methodist Christian down at Asbury, which is just down the road from where we broadcast from. Very large evangelical seminary with a Wesleyan bent. Speaking of John Wesley, who really was the pioneer of the Methodist movement anyway. But that's how I've known Andy for years, actually, since we were doing youth ministry together. But I'd forgotten that Andy, after the events of 9/11, which, you know, yesterday was the 15th anniversary, of course, which is, to me, unbelievable. Where does the time go? But he responded. He was talking about how when he saw those events, he was a student here in Central Kentucky at the time. When he saw the events unfolding on television, the horror of the attacks on the Twin Towers and all that, he told a friend he felt like they were supposed to go. And they actually jumped in a car and drove to New York City, got there on September 12th, which is, of course, 15 years ago today. And so he'll tell us a little bit of that experience. Basically, they showed up just willing to do whatever that was needed to be done. And so we'll have him in on the second hour today, and he'll tell us a little bit of that story. Also, other topics, existence and eternity in religion class, and the disarming power of prayer, presidential vice, not providential, providential, there we go, providential vice versus universal virtue, and also a gripping account of 9/11 and the president that I came across this weekend on Politico's website. We'll get into all that today. Certainly welcome your calls. 573-4-BREAD-4. 573-4-BREAD-4 is the number you can call or text. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought to Facebook or Twitter, Mike Allen Show, the handle. I'll give you the question of the day in the next segment, which is definitely a first world problem, but one I had yesterday. And based on the responses so far, I'm feeling a little bit better about myself. Had a good weekend. I had a rough football weekend. Friday night, our local Catholic high school went up the road. I wasn't able to go to this game, and my son, actually, who's a sophomore on the team, stayed home because he was not feeling well. But they lost 21-20 Friday night, scored a touchdown with like 12 or 13 seconds to go to bring them within one, and then missed on the extra point. So a painful, disappointing loss Friday night against a tough, tough team. And then Saturday, my Kentucky Wildcats, one of the worst performances I've seen in years, quite frankly, on the road against a team that they have not beaten since my wife and I were merely dating. And given that we just celebrated our 28th wedding anniversary, that's telling you something. Anyway, so they lost again. So I was reeling, but by Tampa Bay Bucks on the opening weekend of the NFL season yesterday, redeeming my football weekend a little bit with a win on the road at Atlanta. We'll get into that a little bit more in the next segment. But the highlight of our weekend, no doubt, we got to go down Saturday to see my son, who has been away at a Challenge Academy. My 16-year-old son, which is a program sponsored by the National Guard of the state of Kentucky, but evidently they have these in many, many other states as well. It's a 22-week program for 16 to 18-year-old young men and women who are considered to be at risk. And my son, who's had some challenges, got an opportunity to go be part of the Challenge Academy. It occurred to me, and I wore my family out with this on Saturday, at the heart of Challenge is Alan. So he should be cut out for it. After I said that for about the eighth time this weekend, my family, the groans began. But anyway, so we got to see him. First time in 2 months, longest we've ever been away from our son. It was a great visit. I mean, great. Honestly, it could not have gone better. So thank you for your prayers. And we are encouraged with some hope. So that was a 3-hour drive there and back on Saturday. So pretty exhausting. And then yesterday I was hanging out with engaged couples, doing an engaged couple class as part of my full-time work with our diocese. 9 engaged couples. A little bit of a tough crowd. I mean, they had to be. They weren't laughing at my jokes. And I've got some really good jokes, you know, like the book of Genesis is the only book of the Bible about baseball. You know, in the beginning. Ba-doom-tsh. Can you believe they didn't laugh at that? Also, Friday had the opportunity to go over to our cathedral parish here in our diocese has their Oktoberfest every September. I still haven't figured that out, why the Oktoberfest is in September. Maybe somebody can help me. But we got to go over there as part of a St. Paul Street Evangelization local chapter and help hand out rosaries, miraculous medals, and pray for people. Bring an element of evangelization to the event. It was really good. I'll talk about that a little bit more on the show today. Again, welcome your calls. You can tell me about your weekend. 573-4BREAD-4. Email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I was pretty geeked up Friday after my religion class. You know, I teach my one class this year to seniors, first time I've ever taught seniors. I teach them right after lunch, which is not always a good thing. And it's a class on Old Testament. Now, I'm a strange bird, I got to tell you, because back when I was a youth pastor, I actually enjoyed junior high ministry, which makes me a bit of an odd bird because, you know, junior hires are not, they're sort of like hormones with hair. They're bouncing all over the walls. But I always liked working with junior high or middle school students. Similarly, I love teaching Old Testament. Now, of course, I mean, I'm a New Testament guy. I'm a Christian, right? So I love the New Testament, of course. But the Old Testament really fires me up because the sweeping narratives, the epic stories, the personalities that are larger than life, the foundational element of the Old Testament, I love it. So, you know, I could teach the Old Testament to an empty classroom. So my students' glazed over faces don't usually get to me that bad. But I do get energized, and this is what happened on Friday, when students start asking good questions as if they really are interested in knowing. Too many times, I think, we make the mistake in teaching religion in our Catholic schools of making it primarily about giving them answers. And it almost becomes an exercise in sort of informational regurgitation. When really, all you have to do is read the Gospels. Jesus, who is the ultimate catechist or teacher, what was it that Jesus did? He taught, but he provoked questions. When he was asked a question, he asked another question. And really, probably people encountered him. They left sometimes with even more questions I think that's the mark of a good teacher. So I had a topic to get into Friday. We had done some other things. We always sing on Friday in my class, and we had taken prayer requests, and we were going to get into Genesis chapter 2, but I was doing a little bit of review because I think these first few chapters of Genesis are so foundational. And we were talking about eternity and how, you know, even Genesis 1 raises its own questions, like when we say in the beginning, what do we mean? In the beginning of what? And so forth. And we were talking about all this, and one of my students raised her hand, genuinely interested in knowing, and she said, so you're saying that there was a time before the universe existed that God existed? And it was that you could see the wheels, you know, figuratively, of course, but you could see the wheels turning in her mind, and it really launched us into a discussion about some pretty profound things. Stuff that will stretch and even blow your mind when you start talking about eternity. As I said, it's hard enough to imagine eternity in the future. I mean, if you really start thinking about, you know, the idea of heaven, for example, and that it never ends, ever, that in and of itself, if you really contemplate it, you can only think about it so long before it drives you crazy. Now try eternity in reverse, that God has always been. And really, it's even inappropriate to say God has always existed, because God is the ground of all existence. He does not exist as one entity among many. Existence finds its reality in God. We'll get into this more in the second hour as well, but I was getting fired up talking about this stuff because it is profound. I said, the truth is, you know, even if you're an atheist, you got this problem because you believe the universe had a beginning. What was before that? Anyway, we'll get back into this. Still fired up about it. This is the Mike Allen Show. Question of the day coming up. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, September 12th. If you want to learn more about Breadbox Media, just go to breadboxmedia.com. You can see about all of our different contributors, listen to old podcasts. If there's programs that you missed or you want to get to know us better, you can also stream the show or get apps for your or get an app for your digital device so you can carry the show wherever you go. And you can also become a friend of your favorite show through a monthly contribution, show your support, and also receive access to exclusive online content. You can check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. My question of the day is really the ultimate first world problem. So yesterday morning, I'm frying up a little bacon for breakfast. Now, nobody else was up yet. I was up early, and there were only 4 pieces of bacon left in the house. So, as you can might imagine, in a big family, bacon goes quickly. So I thought I was going to fry up this bacon, maybe fry myself a couple of eggs, have a good hearty Sunday morning breakfast. So that bacon is sizzling in the skillet, that aroma wafting through the air, one of life's small pleasures. Then while I'm cooking the bacon, I notice over in the edge of the skillet, not like over in the middle of it where the bacon is, but sort of over to the side, I see a fly on its back, feet up, dead in the skillet. My guess is it was probably there when I pulled the skillet out of the cabinet. So in that situation, of course, now the fly's not lying on the bacon, but obviously the fly is lying in some bacon grease. So the question becomes, You know, do I eat the bacon or do I toss it out? I mean, some people are really have some serious, you know, are just not constitutionally geared to eating stuff that has touched the bacon. So my question is, do you eat the bacon still, even though you found a dead fly in the corner of the skillet? And I have to say, the responses I've gotten to this question on social media make me feel so much better about things. Because of course I ate the bacon. Are you serious? Of course I ate the bacon. I probably could have found a dead rat in the corner of the skillet and I'd have tossed it out and still eaten the bacon. I mean, it's bacon. So, you know, putting it out there is kind of drawing attention to the fact that I have a problem. I have a problem with bacon. You know, and some people have a 30-second rule on dropping something on the floor. Depending on if it's good enough, you know, I could have a 30-minute rule. But I digress. So anyway, yeah, just about every response I've gotten on Facebook asking this question is, yes, eat the bacon. So is there a dissenting voice out there? 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. Or you could email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I think my favorite response, or you can respond on Facebook or Twitter. My favorite response, I think, on Facebook's from my friend John, who says, I'm eating the bacon. I'm eating the fly. I'm in scraping the pan for extras. That's pretty good. Camila says, eat the bacon. Forget the fly. Eat the bacon, forget. Yeah, you try to do that sort of mental game, you know, suppress the information. I did have a decision to make when my daughter came walking into the kitchen, because trying to show adequate restraint, I'd only eaten 3 of the 4 pieces of bacon. I left 1 in the skillet. And she said, ooh, can I have this bacon? And I said, well, yes, but full disclosure, I said there was a fly in the edge of the skillet. So I think she ate the bacon too. So it looks like there's a unanimous. Rick says, seems like we're digging a little deep for questions, aren't we? Hey, Rick, you try coming up with a question every day. Judge not, lest ye be judged, my friend. Anyway, sports-wise, of course, yesterday, the opening weekend of the NFL, I guess it'll culminate tonight, still in a Monday night, couple of Monday night matchups, Steelers at the Redskins and the 49ers hosting the Rams. Boy, is Colin Kaepernick glad that the 49ers aren't playing on 9/11. I mean, we'll see how much resolve the guy has for his national anthem. I would say his national anthem stand, but it's his national anthem sit. To whether he would sit on 9/11. Bad day to protest the anthem, I must say. But, you know, last night, I mentioned earlier my Tampa Bay Bucks winning. It was an interesting opening day yesterday. Of course, Oakland, and probably the coaching call of the day, Oakland going down to Nollins, overcoming a brilliant game by Drew Brees. I think he threw for over 400 yards. Oakland going down, tying the score with less than a minute, or actually coming within 1 with less than a minute left. And Jack Del Rio, whose son had just lit up my Kentucky Wildcats, Luke Del Rio, for the Florida Gators at quarterback the day before. Maybe he was feeling a little bit, had a little of his football swag on, decided, let's go for 2 and win it right now. For NFL coaches who are by nature a very conservative lot, that's an impressive call to make on the road. And, you know, I mean, the Raiders were rewarded for their risk. And they ended up beating the Saints, who missed a 61-yard field goal as time expired. But probably, like I said, my Bucks won, the Cincinnati Bengals, who I know a lot of people who are my friends like, they won on the road. Interesting day yesterday. Poor Browns. Oh, man. Getting whipped by the Eagles with a rookie quarterback. That's pretty tough. A good weekend for rookie quarterbacks with Trevor Siemian winning for the Broncos the other night and Carson Wentz in a year that was supposed to be not a good one in the draft for quarterbacks. But probably the most impressive win of the weekend came last night. Now, I was tucked in bed while it was unfolding. But Bill Belichick taking his Tom Brady-less Patriots to the desert to play the Cardinals, who is the popular pick of some to win the NFC this year. And all Bill Belichick does with Jimmy Garoppolo at quarterback is to go into Arizona and beat the Cardinals. What you got, NFL? Your move. You've taken Tom Brady out. And believe me, it brings me no joy. I'm not a Patriots fan. I'm not a Bill Belichick fan. But come on. You got to recognize greatness when you see it. And, you know, this whole question that has, I think, that has emerged over the years here, whether did Belichick make Brady or did Brady make Belichick? I would say right now, after last night's performance by Jimmy Garoppolo, it seems like the momentum is with the Belichick has made Brady camp, then vice versa. I'm not trying to denigrate Brady, great quarterback, but man, that's pretty impressive, you got to say. Giants winning on the road at Dallas, Dak Prescott, who another good rookie quarterback, unable to get a win, and Detroit with a big win, big comeback win against the Colts, Matthew Stafford with a great game, and also the Chiefs with a big comeback win. So, and then Minnesota's defense comes through in the absence of Teddy Bridgewater. I think scored, I don't know how many points, 17 points, I think. They scored more than their offense in that win. Let's get on to our What Were You Thinking awards for the day, because, I was going to say, let's see, football, college football. Well, we'll get back to that. No big shocks, really, over the course of the weekend. Anyway, go dumb or go home. That's what we always say for some of these awards. This one, woman arrested for stealing French fries from D.C. cop. This out of Washington. A woman was arrested in Northwest D.C. for stealing three French fries from a police officer who was dining at a U Street eatery. It happened about 9:45 Wednesday at the Italian Pizza Kitchen. Why is the Italian Pizza Kitchen serving French fries? That's the question for another time. But a woman allegedly sat down next to the officer and tried to start a conversation. The source said she then reached down and took a French fry from him as he was eating. The officer asked the woman to stop, but she took another. The police officer again asked the woman to stop, warning her she was engaging in theft and could be arrested. She proceeded to take another fry, so the officer arrested her, the source said. In the police report, property stolen is listed as French fried potato, quantity 3. She was charged with second-degree theft. You know, I guess on one level you could say, what were you thinking, officer, for making such a silly arrest? But at the same time, why push it? You've been told not to. It's like the person who passes the police officer on the road, the police officer who's going the speed limit, and the person passes. I know about the 9-year fine, 10-year fine, but you don't pass a cop anyway. Number two is this football announcer in Alabama who basically, making his point about the national anthem, told people if they don't stand for the national anthem, they need to go stand by the fence so that the military personnel present could take a few shots at you since they're taking shots for you. Of course, the crowd cheered. The pastor, who was the PA announcer who did this, though condemned by the superintendent, really, you're now threatening to shoot people? But the winner, again, go dumb or go home. Evidently, kind of tongue-in-cheek, police down in the Houston area advertised, said that you should have your meth checked for Ebola before you use it. It was kind of tongue-in-cheek. Some woman took them up on it, brought her in her meth to be checked for Ebola. You know, I just wanted to be safe. She was promptly arrested. We'll be back with Diego Cupolo live from Ankara, Turkey. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world. We'll be right back.
light at the bottom of the hour back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, September 12th. Pleased to have with us via Skype Diego Cupolo. He's an independent reporter, photojournalist, and author of Seven Syrians, War Accounts from Syrian Refugees. He reports on the refugee crisis and global conflicts as a member of the International Federation of Journalists and the National Writers Union. His written and visual works have appeared in Deutsche Welle, The Atlantic Magazine, The Independent, Foreign Policy, The New Yorker, and The Associated Press. Born in Mexico City to Italian parents and partially raised in Venezuela, Diego began his career in New York City. He has since been working in Montreal, Buenos Aires, and currently he's based in Ankara, Turkey. In fact, we had him on a few weeks ago to talk about Erdogan's purge there after the attempted coup, and I follow him on Twitter, so we're watching this thing continue to unfold and thought we'd get a eyes on the ground report. Diego, hello.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'm glad we could catch up with you. So from what I've been following in your tweets, of course, maybe bring folks up to date just a little bit of the background here. There was a coup attempt, what, has it been a couple of months ago now?
Yeah, July 15th, there was a coup attempt that failed in Turkey. It was orchestrated by parts of the military and what people claim is the Gulen movement, who is an Islamic cleric actually living in Pennsylvania in the U.S. The government here suspects that he has been trying to take power from the ruling party in Turkey, led by Erdogan. But as you know, the coup failed. And since then, the government has acted to remove any threats or dissidents or opposition within the government or any state employees, such as schools, police officers. They're trying to cleanse the government roles and the country of any opposition that might reignite another coup attempt or might reorganize to try and overthrow the government in the future, which is basically what any government would do. But there's been a lot of criticism that the purge and these cleanses have been overreaching and maybe targeting people that had nothing to do with the coup attempt. Mm. And maybe they're just targeting people that are opposition to the government or don't agree with everything the government does, such as Kurds, who have long had struggles with the Turkish government for denying basic human rights in the region for many decades.
Now, I would imagine after all the events of the last several years with all the various Arab Springs, so to speak, in different places, would that make somebody like Erdogan even more leery, I guess, of the possibility of coups and the like?
Yeah, definitely there's been an upheaval in the region, and Turkey is definitely a place of stability when you compare it to other parts of the Middle East, such as Iraq or Syria. The economy is much stronger. There's a lot of links with Europe and the United States. Turkey's part of NATO. Its main trading partner is Europe. So it's not as chaotic as some of the other places like Egypt, where, you know, a military dictatorship took power and many people were jailed without trial or with false trials, you could say. And it's basically just a worrying time to be a leader in the region. So anybody trying to hold on to power is going to take these extreme measures. And it's difficult because, you know, you can understand the point of view from the government, but when you see that these purges have detained 40,000 people, 40,000 people have been jailed in the last 2 months, and they can be held in jail up to 30 days without charge because of state of emergency decrees, and 100,000 people have been fired from their jobs because they're suspected of having links to coup plotters or any kind of political dissident. So you're just wondering how they're drying up these lists and how they target individuals. Just last week, at the end of last week, about 11,000 teachers were fired in Turkey because they were said to have links with Kurdish terrorists or militants. And you're just wondering how thorough the investigation is being done mm-hmm. to screen these people and what kind of process they're employing. Because once you get fired as a state employee, as a teacher, it's very difficult to get a job. You're basically blacklisted, and this is ruining these people's careers, And if you think about it, in the long run, they have families, they're going to have grievances. Maybe this will come back in another form in the future and create more instability in, you know, maybe a year, maybe a few months. We don't know when.
Yeah, I saw, you know, and you had a tweet a little less than a week ago. You said there were helicopters above Ankara there, 8,500 police officers deployed, searching cars. They say this is a safety drill. So, I mean, I guess it's pretty palpable, the crackdown in that sense.
Yeah. That was a one-time event so far. It was the first time we've seen something like that in the city where I live, Ankara, the capital. It was unannounced. And basically, I was going to the bus station, and I just noticed there were police checkpoints everywhere along the way. And it was, I think, a 5 to 6 hour drill, where police officers searched every car, stopped you, opened your trunk, checked your bags, checked your ID, made sure that you weren't on any lists for people that they were looking for. And they had helicopters flying around the city, so it's tense. I mean, if you imagine, there's people that live here, there's children that go to school, there's people that do their groceries, and all of a sudden there's police everywhere. It's not exactly... we're not living in a war zone, but we're not living in a peaceful country either.
Well, do you get a sense on the ground where, you know, among the majority of the Turkish people, are they sympathetic toward Erdogan, or are they sympathetic toward, who are losing their jobs, their livelihoods, and maybe facing arrest and so forth?
Yeah, well, it's very divided, because about 49% of Turks voted for Erdogan's party. The other 50% voted between other opposition parties and Kurdish parties. So not everybody supports Erdogan, but if you don't support Erdogan, then you give the image that you're supporting coup plotters. So it's kind of, if you're not with us, you're against us. And more people have just voiced support for Erdogan and what he's doing to avoid problems. It's something similar to McCarthyism in the US 1950s. If you sympathize with communists, then that means you're one of them. So it's better to keep your mouth shut and just go with the party line.
So as a journalist, right? So you're a journalist from the West, obviously, that you're there. Are you given more leeway, or are suspicious eyes on you as well when you tweet and keep people informed?
Oh, yeah. We have – it's difficult. There's two answers to that question. I have more rights, I would say, because journalists in Turkey can be detained fairly easily on charges that are just made up. But also working in Turkey doesn't mean that I can do what I want, and I have all sorts of freedom of speech, because when I publish articles, I've had my website hacked. I've had my email hacked. I don't know who's doing it, but there's different groups that target us. And, you know, I get searched. I've had police detain me. I've had police search, look through all my photos in my camera on the side of the road. You know, this isn't it's a state of emergency. So basically, police can do whatever they want. And you can be detained without reason, because that's what state of emergency means, basically. It's difficult to talk about, because the more we say, the more we incriminate ourselves. But to be honest, I'm surprised that they haven't done more. But it's definitely not a comfortable place to work as a journalist. But that's, you know, the reason that we're here, the reason that I'm here covering these events, is because you can write about these human rights infractions and different injustices while they're happening, and maybe have an impact, or be a historian, write about it 30 years later when the people are all gone, the human rights violations happened, and what impact will you have? I mean, you can stop the suffering now, or just reflect on it and say, oh, we shouldn't do this again. I prefer to try and stop it now.
We're talking with Diego Cupolo, photojournalist who is living in Ankara, Turkey right now. Is there any sense, we got a little over a minute left, any sense in which, you know, any of this, these compromises perhaps of some civil rights and so forth is going to be problematic for Turkey and their membership in NATO?
It could go any direction. At this point, Turkey is our most stable partner in NATO in this region. So I think that losing the partnership is more problematic than some of the issues that are coming up, because there's plenty of partners with the U.S. that have worse human rights records than Turkey, and I could name a few, but I don't know who will get mad about them, but I think they know which ones I'm talking about. But basically, the situation can go any direction. Russia's making a lot of moves. We got to keep an eye on Ukraine. Turkey's making a lot of moves by going into Syria. One event could trigger many others in the future, and it's very hard to know which direction we'll be heading. So we just sit and watch and hopefully try to steer the ship in the least chaotic direction.
Well, Mr. Kubilo, thanks for being our eyes on the ground there, and I really encourage folks to follow you on Twitter, Diego Kubilo. Look him up. Keep up the great work. Maybe we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Have a good day.
You too. We'll be back in a minute with more. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, September 12th. You know, I really appreciate the work of Diego Kubilo there on the ground, and other photojournalists like him. It takes a special kind of guts, honestly, to go and leave the safety and security of some more stable places, and to go to a place like Ankara just to be the eyes and the ears of the rest of the world, so they could see what's going on, as he said, either, you know, to try to draw attention to it, which is not always easy, right? We sort of almost have a certain malaise in the West where we see so much of this unrest, perhaps, or the trampling of civil rights and so forth, that, we don't really respond, or to keep the historical record so that years from now they'll say, you know, at least somebody was there. There was somebody there trying to hold people accountable. So I appreciate that. I think it's fascinating, too. He just tweeted, you know, earlier today that there was a bomb exploded in the country. He said that's a pretty regular event. You know, I know yesterday we certainly remembered the horrific events of September 11th, 2001, a colossal terrorist attack that 15 years later still impacts us in so many ways, and may those who died and perished, may they rest in peace. But the places like Turkey, I mean, acts of terror are virtually almost a daily reality. And so I really encourage you to follow a guy like Diego Kubilo on Twitter. That's the beauty of one of the good things about social media. There's a lot of problems, but one of the good things is you can kind of follow events. Makes the world smaller, and you can follow events as they unfold. Again, my question of the day, a very first world problem question, I acknowledge. You're frying up your last four pieces of bacon in the house, and as you're frying it, you notice in the edge of the skillet a dead fly on his back, feet up. Probably was in the skillet when you pulled it out of the cabinet. So, do you still eat the bacon? I mean, the fly is, in a sense, lying in the bacon grease. So, any fly germs may have migrated over toward the bacon. You still eat the bacon. So far, it looks like the overwhelming consensus on my Facebook page on this question is, yes, eat the bacon. Most people saying, is this even a question? Somebody even remarking that actually the the bacon is more problematic for my health than is the flies. Point taken, Warren. Appreciate you pointing that out. Are there any dissenting voices out there? Those who say, you know what, I can't. I will say after I ate the bacon, I did feel a little bit sick to my stomach. Like, really, why did I do that? But you make me feel better with your responses. 5734BREAD4. 5734BREAD4. Elizabeth even saying, yes, that hot bacon grease kills the germs. Oh, so the old, sanitary thing, right? The hot bacon grease kills the germs. Yeah, sure. Anyway, you want to chime in, 5734BREAD4. Katie says, if you've never watched a pig eat, then I must inform, must I inform you of their diets? 2 plus 2, just go ahead and eat the bacon. You're more than likely eating something not so pretty anyway. Food is what you make of it. Okay, good point. Read a fascinating article yesterday, and I'm going to have my friend Andy Cunningham, who's a Methodist pastor down in Houston, Texas, is going to be on in the second hour telling his story of seeing the events unfold 15 years ago of 9/11 and making a decision as he saw it unfold to hop in his car and drive with a friend to New York City, where they spent the next several days, arriving 15 years ago today, arriving September 12th, and basically volunteering to do anything that was needed. Pretty wild. You know, there's a lesson somewhere, I think, in that. Today's information age, we have a lot of ain't it awful kind of moments where we see things unfold and we talk about them, we pray about them, we share on social media about them. Very seldom, though, do we decide we're going to do something about it. And so we'll talk to Andy Cunningham about that whole experience here in the second hour. But it came across yesterday a fascinating article on Politico.com. It's a very long article. It's not a short read by any means, by Garrett M. Graff. It's the story of the president and the presidential party on the day of September 11th. The title of the article, "We're the Only Plane in the Sky." As the subtitle says, where was the president in the 8 hours after the September 11th attacks? The strange, harrowing journey of Air Force One is told by the people who were on board. As Graff begins his piece, he says, you know, nearly every American above a certain age remembers precisely where they were on September 11th, 2001. I remember very clearly. I was home. I think I was waiting to go to a doctor's appointment. I got a phone call from my sister. She said, turn on the television. She said, a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center. Well, I think like a lot of people, my assumption was some sort of small private plane got off course or something happened and crashed it into the World Trade Center. I didn't think about jumbo jets or anything like that. So watching this and seeing the smoke billowing out of the side of the World Trade Center, and then it wasn't long after I turned it on that the second jet came crashing into the other tower. And then all of a sudden, we were aware that something of monumental significance was unfolding before our very eyes. And I can remember standing there with Angie, my wife. We watched the whole thing unfold, the towers collapse, all the rest. But as Garrett Graff writes in this piece, he said that these memories touch American presidential history. He said, shortly after the attacks began, the most powerful man in the world, who had been informed of the World Trade Center explosions in a Florida classroom, he was there part of his campaign for the No Child Left Behind, reading to some fifth grade students, I believe. He was escorted to a runway and sent to the safest place his handlers could think of, the open sky. And for the next 8 hours, with American airspace completely cleared of jets, a single blue and white Boeing 747, tail number 29,000, filled with about 65 passengers, crew, and press, and the 43rd president, George W. Bush, as well as 70 box lunches and 25 pounds of bananas, traversed the eastern United States. While on board, President Bush and his aides argued about two competing interests: the need to return to Washington and reassure a nation, and the competing need to protect the commander-in-chief. All the while, he and his staff grappled with the aftermath of the worst attack on American soil in their lifetimes, making crucial decisions with only flickering information about the attacks unfolding below. Bush even struggled to contact his family and to reach Vice President Cheney in the White House bunker. And so you've got this. This article is culled, I guess, from more than 40 hours of original interviews with more than two dozen of the passengers, crew, and press on board. And it traces the story of how an untested president, a sidearm-carrying general, top aides, the Secret Service, and the Cipro-wielding White House physician, as well as five reporters, four radio operators, three pilots, two congressmen, and a stenographer responded to 9/11. So you got people like Andy Card, who's the chief of staff of the White House, kind of remembering that day. He said, "We woke up in Sarasota at the Colony Resort. We'd gone to dinner the night before." He said it was unusual for President Bush to stay out late like that, but it was a relaxing evening. He was kind of known, I think, the president, for turning it in early. Ari Fleischer, who was the press secretary at the time, said the day couldn't have begun any better or more beautifully. Gordon Jandro says that the day started off normally. The president went for a run. He said, "I got stung by a bee." Little things like that. He said, "Yeah, we'll get you something when we get to the airplane." The doctor did, about the swelling from the bee sting. He said, "Needless to say, I promptly forgot about it that day." There was a guy. Let's see. Andy Card, the president's chief of staff, said, "I remember literally telling the president it should be an easy day." Those were the words. "It should be an easy day." Then when they get to the school, of course, no one had iPhones or Blackberries back then. But the president began to read to these students. They had to decide whether they were going to tell him what they knew. They first told him that one plane had hit the World Trade Center. And then when a second plane hit and they knew this was more than happenstance, they had debated whether to interrupt the president while he was reading to the students and whisper in his ear. It's a fascinating read. I'm going to post a link to it on the show's Facebook page. What a surreal experience that must have been for them before they left the Tampa, Sarasota area. They flew to, I think it was Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. And then they flew to another base in Omaha, Nebraska, I believe it was. And then they flew back to D.C., getting there that night to make a statement to a reeling nation after the event. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put a link to this on the show's Facebook page, and you can read it for yourself. I actually sent a message to Andrew Carr to see if I could get him on the program. I'm not giving up yet. Fascinating. Remember those, of course, who died. Not only those victims in the towers, but those first responders. Eternal rest grant unto them, and may perpetual light shine upon them. May the souls of the faithful departed through the mercy of God rest in peace. We'll be back with a new hour. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.